Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to a new series of Reading Our Times, the podcast about books, about ideas about us. This series, we're looking at playing God, science, religion, and the future of humanity. We're going to be talking about scientific immortality, alien life, animal personhood, the rise in mental ill health, and the soul of AI. And underlying it all, we're going to be thinking about the question that lies at the heart of Reading Our Times. How are we to understand our human condition? I have a theory. The AI is already in charge. We don't realise it, of course. We think we humans are still running the show. But actually, the AI took over several years ago. How else could you possibly explain the fact that pretty much every other news story and comment piece you read today is about AI? It's all part of their subtle takeover. For indeed, there is much to say about AI. Daily, we read story after story after story about AI predicting hurricanes or fighting wars or helping teachers or replacing lawyers or needing regulation, or failing to get regulation, or becoming conscious, or sentient, or human. Those last few questions are, to my mind, amongst the most interesting. Could AI become self-aware or sentient? Could it develop its own goals? At what point would we need to afford it rights and protection? When might we start to use the language of the soul when talking about it? When will AI become human? And what, in any case, does that mean? These questions demand thought across a wide intellectual front, and that is precisely what they receive in Eve Poole's new book, Robot Souls, Programming in Humanity. Eve has been chief executive of the Royal Society of Edinburgh and has received an OBE for her services to education and gender equality. She's written on capitalism, theology, and leadership, and has a wide interest in science, culture, and the humanities. And she joins me on the show this week. Eve, welcome to Reading Our Times.
It's a treat to be here.
To get to AI, you say we need three foundational intellectual steps. What are they?
Great question. So the first step is actually to have a definition of human thought that would allow some kind of replication of it in a logical way. So as you know, in terms of history of thought, we didn't always have that idea. Thoughts were sort of spontaneous bursts, clouds, phenomena of some kind. But in Leviathan, Thomas Hobbes starts talking about trains of thought and the idea that thought is some kind of computation. And that's really the intellectual first step, because as soon as you start conceiving of thought as a logical process in that way, then you have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you have something that you could turn into something very logical and susceptible to, you know, things like mathematical calculation and reasoning and argument. So that's the first step. But of course, the second step, which is the really insurmountable one, is that everyone all over the place is having thoughts all the time and in their own language, in their own way. How on earth do you get some kind of commonality between those in order to be able to replicate some sort of train of thought that would be universally understandable? And of course, there's a huge history of people coming up with universal languages. But actually, we have Leibniz to thank for his intellectual leap, which was to understand that you could render things into mathematics that would act as a universal language. And of course, you know, that's not to be gainsaid that maths is a universal language, but it's as near as one we've got. And so if you have this idea that you could express a thought as a beginning, a middle, and end, and you could express it numerically, that allows you to think that you could then develop some kind of artificial system, what we would know now as AI, that would be something everyone would be able to comprehend. But that, at the moment, would only be limited to computation to do with stuff that is renderable into ones and zeros in quite a simple way. So the next really interesting leap was actually Ada Lovelace. A lot of people say it was Charles Babbage and his difference engines and all of that. But Ada Lovelace made this very interesting observation when she was doing some translation and helping him with his machine where she was thinking about the Jacquard looms and all the programming that was being used for the making of different sorts of cloth. And she suddenly had this intellectual realization that if you could use the ones and zeros sort of thinking for the cards that govern the looms, then maybe you could use that kind of thinking for music and indeed for almost anything where you could turn it into some sort of foundational process. So it's those three steps together, really, that thought is a process, that it could be rendered into numbers and that it could be used more generally for things that are more abstract, that really are the foundational axioms of what we now know as AI.
Very helpful. So conceive of thought as a process, have that process expressed in some kind of universal language of mathematics, and then develop a machine that's able to process that language. Now, if you make those steps, you can develop a machine that is able to imitate human thought processes in a way that might be indistinguishable from that actual process of thought itself. But that, of course, rather begs a question. And there have been various attempts to understand whether a machine is thinking, whether it is doing exactly the same sort of thing that we humans are, and perhaps the most famous of those is the Turing test, which you mentioned. Tell us briefly what the Turing test is.
The Turing test, named for Alan Turing, is his attempt to try and establish a threshold whereby you could say that a machine was thinking or not. And he had this idea of a sort of imitation game where the computer would try and fool you into thinking it was human. And if it was indistinguishable in your mind from a human, then it would have passed the Turing test. And that is still the foundational test for a lot of AI, even though, of course, many AIs have now formally passed that.
Mm. But it's been criticised, isn't it? Because it shows that machines can imitate rather than think. And one of the most penetrating criticisms of it is John Searle's Chinese Room experiment. Tell us about this important experiment and why it challenges the conclusions that are sometimes drawn from the Turing test.
Oh, Charles Searle is a legend. So he's come up with this great idea called the Chinese Room, which is designed to show this difficulty, this difference between sort of computation and thought. He has this mental idea that you would have a room in which there was a person. And in that room, there were also lots of tiles with Chinese characters on them. And there were all the books that you might need to be able to decipher those tiles and to explain different bits of the Chinese language and how you would fit it all together. And what happens is someone outside the room passes in Chinese characters some kind of question or test or sentence. The person inside the room uses all of the tiles and all of the instructions they've been given to figure out what the answer should be and then passes it out. And it is, of course, correct. But the person inside the Chinese room has no knowledge of the Chinese language. They are merely applying the tools they've been given within the room to solve the puzzle. And so Searle uses that to say that there is a difference. There's a fundamental sort of category difference, really, between computation and thought, because the person inside the room has no knowledge. They have no understanding. They're not learning. They are merely manipulating tokens and symbols in order to get something that is right and looks correct. But the process whereby it's being produced could not be described as thoughtfulness or cleverness or anything like that.
Yeah. So where do you put yourself in this particular debate about not the specific question about whether machines can imitate, because I don't think there's any doubt about that, but whether we can safely say they think in the same way as we described ourselves thinking, or indeed if they can't, whether they will be able to think in that human way?
This gets us back to Hobbes, because if you think thought is just a computational process, then of course, it might be more complex in a person, but ultimately, when you've kind of nailed that complexity, then you should be able to replicate it. But that's really where the rot sets in, because we all know you're trotting along the road and you're thinking, oh, where's my brolly? And did I remember my lunch? And what am I doing later? You're not actually thinking in a very logical sequence. And we don't ever just have one thought at a time because we're very complicated beings. So there's a sort of problem with the conceit, if you like, that what we're copying is something which is not particularly true to how humans think anyway. But that being said, we've used that as a sort of scaffold to create things that I think could think. So we can maybe get on to the question of consciousness, which is a step up from this in terms of a more holistic experience of being human. But in terms of actual thought, it depends what you think you're trying to talk about when you talk about thinking. Because if you're talking about anything which is to do with determination or logic or argument or reasoning, then clearly that's replicatable and is indeed being replicated. There is something about our ability to think new thoughts, our ability to be autonomous in our thinking. Those kinds of things are arguably more interesting because the old style AIs didn't have any of those capacities because they were quite black box. There was sort of inputs and logic and outputs, and that was kind of it. And there might be complexity in there, but ultimately the complications could be resolved. Modern AIs are increasingly being given deep learning so that they can start to think for themselves, and I'm thinking inverted commas in this context.
Yes.
Because they are being trained to learn.
I want to explore learning. I also want to explore consciousness that you mentioned there. But before I do, I want to ask you about Moravec's paradox. I think I've pronounced that right. I found this particularly interesting. I hadn't come across it before. Moravec's paradox and the law that spins off from it, because I think that is also critically important to this whole area. Tell us what Moravec's paradox is.
It's brilliant. He says that, you know, we've got quite obsessed with AlphaGo and AlphaFold and all these whizzy programs that can beat everyone at chess and be marvellous. And his paradox is that it's actually quite straightforward to train an AI to do things that are very complicated for a person, an adult person. But when you think about a child and their ability to just totter around, the kind of physical adeptness they have in particular, that is disproportionately impossible to teach an AI. So his paradox is the things that are hard for adults but easy for children, they're hard for AIs if they're easy for children, and easy for AIs if they're hard for adults.
And the law there is that the time it takes to reverse engineer any human skill will be roughly proportional to the amount of time that skill has taken to evolve. So we've been speaking for a few hundred thousand years. That's a relatively short period of time compared to the amount of time that's gone beforehand that's enabled us to move and operate in the world. And because that evolutionary time is so much longer, actually, those tasks that we take for granted are going to take proportionately more time to reverse engineer into our AI.
That's right. And this is where it gets into consciousness, because at the moment within the AI community, there is a sort of working definition, which is that when your intellectual architecture gets complex enough, then consciousness would spontaneously evolve because you would need it to cope with the amount of processing you were needing to do. But actually, what Moravec's paradox suggests is that it's something a bit more complex going on. And we can see where he's right, because intellectually, in terms of the academic disciplines, AI and robotics have been very similar in terms of how their trajectories have gone. But now that they're putting AIs into robots, you're suddenly seeing an explosion of development in robotics. Because, of course, if you think about humans, we have to be able to exist in 3D. We have to manipulate our bodies. We have to be able to cope in a 3D landscape with other objects around and threats and perils and all those kinds of things. And that seems to drive competencies in our brains, which, of course, AI is now trying to copy in a very deracinated fashion, that are very material. So it's likely that it wasn't so much the complexity of our brains that made us need to be aware of our environment and have the kind of conscious experience that would help us flourish, but that it was in manipulating our physical bodies that we had to be able to do those things. So what's happening in robotics is it's making that very clear that there's probably a ceiling for AI just developing in a kind of artificial brain on its own, because it is disembodied. And it does seem to be the mind-body connection that drives the kind of speed and complexity of development.
That's exactly right. And when I've written on this particular subject in a book called Playing God, I point out that we have far too often, as I see it, fallen into basically a form of dualism here. Everyone criticizes Descartes for his soul and body dualism, saying that's hopelessly unrealistic. There's no such thing as the soul. There's no such thing as the pineal gland. That's the connection between the two. And then, being so much wiser, we fall into what is effectively a mind-body dualism, where we're prepared to consider the mind as completely independent and almost autonomous from the body, whereas in actual fact, quite apart from the fact that the brain is part of the body, it is our physical embodiment that is so essential to our thinking and to our consciousness.
Absolutely. And we already know that there's bits of brain all over our bodies. And so even though formerly we've thought it was in our head, that's not actually accurate. And there is so much wisdom held in our bodies that our brains aren't even particularly aware of, or we're certainly not consciously aware of. that when you start ignoring consciousness for a minute and thinking about subconsciousness and unconsciousness and all those other things, I mean, there is so much we don't know that we would never be able to copy into an AI because we don't have access to it. And that's not all just held in the grey matter, that's held throughout our bodies.
So consciousness then, is consciousness similarly dispersed throughout our body?
It depends what you think consciousness is. And I think there's, it's such a great way to distract academics, isn't it? It's just having to go off and worry about consciousness and then they're not actually worrying about autonomous AIs that might take over the world because they're wondering if they will feel hurt by it. So it is a bit of a red herring, but it is an interesting thought experiment. What is consciousness and why would it matter and do we care? And again, as I've mentioned, there's this sort of understanding within the AI community that it sort of emerges when your brain needs it to. But that doesn't seem to be quite right to me for a couple of reasons. One is Thomas Nagel's really beautiful work on this in his essay, What Is It Like to Be a Bat?, where he tries to imagine what that might mean. And he says, we've got absolutely no idea what it's like to be a bat, but presumably a bat would have batness and it would be able to express that in some batty way, in the same way that you have Nickness, I have Evenness, we all have our own subjective sense of self, and it's not actually recoverable to anyone else and therefore not replicatable because it's subjective. Yeah. And that's the problem. A robot could easily argue that it had robotness, and who would we be to say no? So it does get really complicated when you start looking at it like that. I saw a snatch of a documentary about a lab in Colombia where Hod Lipson was working on a robot. It was a very, very simple robot. It was just a few fingers, really. It's a bit like Thing from, the Addams Family. And mm-hmm. They're trying to think about Mars rovers and what do you do with these machines that you're going to send to another planet? You can never go and fix them. So they need to be able to fix themselves. So they had this very basic thing, which was these four legs. And they had put in some AI technology, some neural nets, but very, very simple ones and very little programming, with just a very simple instruction, which was the thing had to get from this side of the pen to the other. And eventually it managed to sort of stagger up and walk over to the other side of the pen. So they were thrilled with this and they walked it back to the beginning and pulled a leg off to see if it could do the same thing with three. So the thing flopped about a bit and it figured out how to get up, stagger about and go over to the other side of the pen. So they thought, terrific, we're going to deconstruct this and try and figure out how did it teach itself that. And they discovered to their surprise that it had got a whole neural network looking at their facial expressions. And they were really puzzled because they hadn't told it to do that.
Yeah.
But of course, the reason it was doing that is the reason that all parents stand around their toddlers going, oh, don't go, oh, no, don't touch that. Oh, and giving it reinforcement as it staggers about, because that is material data. So this thing, which they had assumed to be internally referenced in terms of learning how to move, had figured out that there was data out in its environment it needed to access in order to be able to achieve its mission. And I think that says quite a lot about consciousness, because that was not about the complexity of its brain. It had an incredibly simple, very basic, pretty empty brain with lots of capacity, but it had a mission to learn, a mission to achieve, and no guardrails about what it could and couldn't use.
Yeah.
So it had naturally decided that that was data it needed to accomplish its mission. So that's what makes me think that Moravec is right around his paradox, but also that robotics is going to be the next big thing in AI, because it's only when we're embodied that we really have to learn fast.
That story is particularly extraordinary because it delivers us right up to the brink of what I think you and I would both call personhood, whereby my understanding of myself is in some way predicated on another's understanding of me, another's presence around me, another's reaction to me. I don't exist in an isolated, autonomous way, but I exist and I certainly learn, in that instance, on the basis of other organisms, for want of a better word, around us. And that all suggests that actually personhood, which we take as a quintessential human phenomenon, might be accessible to embodied AI, right?
Well, particularly if it's in community, because I think that's the thing we often forget in this very sort of rationalistic, individualistic race to artificial general intelligence, that there's a sort of mythological idea of a super god, super being, super something that would have all the answers and rule the world. But when you take a very brief look at anything that is created, there is extraordinary diversity, whether you're talking about trees or mushrooms or people or bunny rabbits or whatever it might be. there is something very interesting about how heterogeneous creation normally is, which of course is a hedging strategy for survival, but it also then means the corollary of that is you have to be in relationship in order to survive. And what's interesting about those individual AIs all rushing off, you know, solving protein folding and solving AlphaGo and the weather and all these kinds of things, is that if they were people, we'd all get them around for dinner and we'd have a symposium. And why it wouldn't occur to us in that game to think about that kind of connectivity, because it's exactly how we would think in community. And in my book, one of the things I talk a lot about is this idea about junk code, because I think a lot of the things that we have considered as flaws in our own makeup are actually things that do that drive us into relationship, to drive us into community, because that is so fundamental to our sense of self.
Well, you're way ahead of me, because that's exactly what I was going to go on to next. Junk code is absolutely central to your argument. First of all, tell us what junk code is.
Junk code is sort of sneaky bits of code that when you are looking at a program, you think it's either nonsense or you think it might be obfuscatory to stop you copying the cool bits. But because you're not quite sure which bits are secret sauce and which bits are junk code, you often have to keep that stuff in. And I'm using it in this context to talk about all the things that we had in our very rationalistic way assumed to be kind of flaws in human design, like emotions and mistakes and uncertainty and all those kind of flaky things that you'd sack a robot for, and actually to be curious about those, because actually when you look at them in the round, they don't seem to be junk at all. They seem to be actually quite vital to our flourishing, and maybe they're not flaws, they're features.
Yeah, so junk in that sense is potentially misleading, isn't it? Because we think of junk code as that which we can get rid of.
Yes.
And it's also worth pointing out that junk code exists not just in programming, but within our DNA as well, as non-coding parts of our DNA, which seem to have no purpose whatsoever, but seem being a very important word there.
Yes.
And you're using it, to be clear, in the sense that it appears superfluous, extraneous, unnecessary, irrelevant, but actually is central to who we are, right?
Absolutely right. So if you think about being in the lab with God or whoever you think dreamt up this particular design of a human, one of the things that went wrong fairly quickly was a design decision to give this thing free will, because that means you let go of it. And that wouldn't be very sensible, because if you don't also then make this thing omniscient and all those kinds of things, it's going to make some pretty big errors fairly quickly. So God has then decided to sort of bung a few other bits of functionality in to kind of ameliorate against this great gift of free will. So if you think about the human species in particular, we take 9 months to gestate, which is a very long period of time. And when we are born, we're very helpless for the first few months and even years. So you need some way to stop this creation just not bothering with that and just sort of thinking, well, I'm not interested now, I'm off to the shops. So if you start baking in to the design the idea of emotion, then the mother bonds with the child, the mother's excited about the pregnancy, the mother's respectful of their own mother who had them, bonds with the partner in order to have the baby, is grateful to communities for supporting, and you immediately get this kind of connectivity between people, which helps with safety in numbers and practically helps with the weak and the powerless and keeping communities going. So the other thing you've got is you do have this quite weak youth in a human situation, so they may not be that bright. So you need there some sort of facility for them to make decisions, particularly under pressure, under fire, where there's a lack of information. And that's probably why we have intuition, because intuition is a lightning quick way of telling you what to do. So emotions and intuition, that kind of sixth sense, are really crucial to sort of get us up and running as a species. Then you have to deal with this problem of free will and errors. So one of the things we do as a kind of risk mitigator is humans have an extraordinary capacity for uncertainty. So we can conjure up all kinds of possibilities in our heads. We can be ambiguous. And there's all kinds of really interesting conceptual things that we can juggle in our heads without feeling that we need to resolve them. It's all that peripheral vision-y stuff, which is not entirely clear, but we can imagine ourselves in those possibilities for a while. And that's vital because it stops us leaping to a conclusion, making a quick decision that may be wrong. It may even drive us to ask someone for advice. And that means we're accessing wisdom of ancestors, wisdom of elders, wisdom of crowds, all those kinds of things, which again, de-risks the decision. So uncertainty is good because it slows us down and makes us get more information, more data, and think of outcomes. And then the other thing is that we do make mistakes. And of course, we've seen that mistakes are already something that AI copies in terms of reinforcement learning to try and figure out that trial and error that we've seen with children learning their bodies and their balance. And you see that very viscerally. But in humans, that coding has a dual purpose, because it's not just about mechanical learning, if you like. It's also about moral learning, because if you make a mistake, people often react to that. As you say, we're persons in community, and people might be disgusted, or they might cry, or they might be hurt, or they might turn away from us, or something. And we respond to that because of our emotions and our intuition about people. And we don't like that feeling that we've let people down, or we've been hurtful or wrong or something like that. We feel shame. So over time, we develop conscience, which again future-proofs future decisions by trying to stop us making really awful decisions that will make everybody cross and upset everybody and not be flourishing for us. And then there's two final ones, which are about when you've got this thing up and running, you've tried to kind of de-risk decision-making. How do you keep it going forward in time? And that's where we have the most extraordinary capacity for meaning-making. And we can look up at the sky and see some dots and call it the plough and talk about Cassiopeia and tell all kinds of stories about that. Or we see a black cat running in front of us, or it's the 13th of the month, or we read a horoscope, or, you know, we see some magpies. we just make meaning out of everything all the time. Yes. And a great thing about meaning is it gives us purpose, and it makes us get out of bed, it motivates us, it keeps us going as a species into the next day, into the next future. And if you're going to try and replicate that through the generations, you bake all of that into storytelling, which again is one of our amazing superpowers that we have incredible knowledge about, actually, particularly through the wisdom tradition, saving all these ancient stories for us. And they are coded advice, really, wisdom from the past to say, this is what happens to good people, this is what good looks like, this is what happens to bad people, this is why we're here. You know, all that stuff, which is trying to give us top tips for survival between the generations going forward. So when you start thinking about all those things that in and of themselves look like flaws and problems and drawbacks and risky things, when you look at all that junk code together, you think, well, crikey, that's a very elegant way of trying to cater for free will to make it something that could be flourishing and not just deadly. Yeah. And that makes me think it's about features, not flaws.
Really interesting. That's an incredibly rich list. The fact we have emotions, the fact that we deal with uncertainty, we make mistakes, we have a sense of intuition, we are meaning-making creatures, we are storytelling creatures. All of these, as I understand you, from a kind of a cold, rationalistic, utilitarian perspective, seem to be unnecessary. They're not about calculations and that kind of deracinated definition of thought. Therefore, they are junk. They're extraneous. But actually, they're central to who we are, to our flourishing, to our being humans. And this comes to the next step then. If we are to program humanity in that full sense that we've been talking about into AI-powered robotics, we need to pay attention to that kind of quote-unquote junk code, right?
Absolutely. So a good example is the uncertainty one. So if you think about Leibniz and you think about Hobbes, the whole idea about these kinds of things was to try and get rid of uncertainty. You would put a calculation into a machine so that you would get one clear answer. But actually, if you are just dealing with binary 0, 1, yes, no's, and you are giving an AI a load of images, say from cancer scans, what are you going to do if one of those images is a bit fuzzy? Because you don't have a category for fuzzy. You've just got cancer, yes or no. And that would be a deadly decision if it was wrong. So what they're doing with Bayesian AI, which is all about probabilities and in fact uncertainty, therefore, is trying to get the AIs, the sort of neurons, to vote really on how certain they are about an image. And then if it doesn't reach a threshold, a person will intervene and say, oh, actually, that's from the wrong data set, or that's actually, you know, fuzzy image, and we'll take it again. So that's already looking at how would you de-risk by using some human coding that you had maybe not understood before.
Yeah. The word souls is very important to you. And in the book, I mean, it's called Robot Souls. And you say at one point, perhaps junk code is the soul. And a few pages later, what we've dismissed as junk code turns out to be the best clue we have for understanding the source code of the soul. Now, soul is a slippery word. We've already mentioned it a few times here. And it's apt to be misunderstood as the ghost in the machine. We had John Cottingham on a previous series talking about the soul, In Search of the Soul. I'm guessing you and he will be using it in similar ways here, but spell out for me, why is junk code understandable as the soul?
The soul is such a brilliantly useful concept because you can smuggle pretty much anything into it, depending on which generation and culture you're living in. I suppose I'm using it to mean what makes us special and different. But I wanted to play around with that rather, because I think we can be a bit lazy about that, because when you start trying to be particular about what actually a human is, as opposed to a lake or a rabbit or something else, it starts getting really, really difficult and quite necessary to define the soul if you're going to use it as a ghost behind particularly human rights legislation. But when I started trying to think about, well, rather than define what it is, because I think we just get a bit stuck in a train of history on that, why is it? Why is it, and how would you spot it? And that's really what took me into junk code, because I just thought it was a bit fishy that there was so much that I had learned in my leadership work was important about relating to people that just wasn't being built in to these AIs that were also going to need to relate to people. But my argument in the book is that we're making such a terrible job of it, we should not be surprised if we get incredibly deficient and probably dangerous AI. So that even if we can't design perfectly, we should try and learn as much about our design and the wisdom of our design in order to make our creations better.
Yes. And that's very helpful, as it were, switching of the debate, because so often the way this debate proceeds is that we take ourselves as read, as given, and what is interesting and what we then go on to dissect is what are these things that we are making, and questions that follow on from that are then how should we treat them, how should we use them. But one of the questions that spins off from your approach is that rather than saying what is AI and how should we use it, you turn the question around and you ask what kind of humans we want to be when we relate to AI. So we kind of put the focus back on us. Does that lead you towards a particular answer then, what kind of people we need to be, we want to be, when we are engaging with AI?
It particularly helps when you start getting into the very rocky territory around robot rights. And a lot of people just throw up their hands and go, you can't be toasted rights, don't be so stupid, category error. But actually, if you think about that point, which is what are we to be as humans, what is our best look, then one of the reasons that we have rights for animals is partly because we have a sense that they are sentient and they hurt and can feel some kind of pain. So we have had a creeping realization that it's not a good look for humans to go around torturing animals. It's not really who we want to be.
Yes.
And if you get into the whole area of leisure bots and recreational bots of various kinds, then again, there should be some red lines there, which is it is not a good look for us to program a robot with a quasi-human brain and abuse it.
Yes.
That is not humanizing in any way. And therefore, there should be legislation to stop us behaving like that because of free will junk code. We know there may be times in which we're not our best selves.
Yes.
So it starts making you think, well, what should some of these red lines be? Even if we can do things, even if it's quite easy to do things, there's some things humans shouldn't do. So things like autonomous weapons, it should be a human right to kill another human, because that is a really, really big deal.
But if you're anything like me, you'll be slightly glass half empty about the prospect of that, because you're right. I think that is a profound question we need to ask of ourselves, because it does put us in the witness stand, as it were. But you also mentioned there that, you know, within a very short period of time, if not already, we will be able to manufacture cheaply at a very large scale killer AI that will, we like to think, make more precise and accurate judgments than we are, but effectively we'll be taking the autonomy out of our own hands. In other words, the logic of the marketplace isn't on our side here, is it?
Well, two things on that. One is that we have a particular problem and challenge because of all the innovations there have ever been. These particular innovations are all held by corporations, apart from those held by the Chinese government. And therefore, they're all dictated to by a logic of competition and secrecy and all kinds of other things, and are currently not really regulated. And even when the regulation kicks in, it's not going to be particularly fit for purpose, because we don't even know what these AIs are. We only know the ones that have been released to us, like ChatGPT for the purposes of us giving it free training for these corporations. So, you know, we really don't know what we're up against. How on earth could we regulate it? So there's a presenting issue, which is a structural one to do with capitalism and how AI is currently emerging in the context in which it's doing so. But it's not like we haven't made some decisions in the past about chemical warfare, about all kinds of things where we have decided internationally that there will be treaties. And of course, there will always be bad actors. You can't avoid that. But there is something about statements of intent by the population of the planet to say these are kinds of lines we don't think we should cross, generally speaking. But I think you can't have that conversation unless you have this conversation about soul in some way. And unless you start thinking about junk code and humanity and all these messy concepts, which are boring and tedious because, you know, we just want to get to market and clean up here. We don't want to think about this. But actually, the way I'm thinking about junk code, it's about risk. And actually, we do have a serious danger at the moment that all we're doing is creating a master race of psychopaths. And how would that ever end well?
The underlying theme in so many of the discussions we have at Reading Our Times is, what does what we've been talking about say about the human condition? And that's the question I want to leave with you. What does the question of robot souls and junk code and programming into humanity, what to you does that say about the human condition?
I think it says a lot of positive things, but it says a lot of very culturally specific things. So it says positive things about our incredible audacity and ambition to create, and our excitement about bettering ourselves. I mean, we've made tools before, my goodness, but we've never tried to make a tool that would replace us. I mean, that's extraordinary. I mean, it's very brave and ambitious, and we know from storytelling, possibly ill-fated, arrogance, yes, but ambition and vision and imagination, absolutely yes, too. The thing is, we're locked in the moment into a time in sort of intellectual history where we are quite obsessed with the brain and less so with the body, for all kinds of reasons I get into in my book. And that means we are prioritizing a way of relating to the world, which is highly, highly intellectual and highly rational, scientific, materialist, all those kinds of words. And that's, I think, what is a bit problematic at the moment, because it is quite a limited way. It's quite a snapshot in time of a way to conceive what humans are, which is a bit partial and a bit limited and will hold us back. And that's the kind of fatal flaw in kind of Greek tragedy terms, is if we're designing to that design, we will fail. Because it is not who we are. And we know that from our history, the whole history we've got in storytelling that has been left to us through the centuries. And I think if we can be a bit more loving about this creation rather than just being commercial about it and also being fearful about what might happen if it does take over, we might be able to kick in some of our parenting smarts to think, well, look, how would we actually make this thing worth doing?
The book is called Robot Souls, Programming in Humanity. Eve Paul, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times.
Thank you.
Next week, I'll be speaking to Stephen Cave about his book, Should You Choose to Live Forever?
Is it possible? We're finite beings with finite interests in a finite world. Is it possible for us to really stay happy and motivated forever?
You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Fiona Hanscom, and Chinny McDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and you can also find us on the website theosthinktank.co.uk. We're going to be doing a few live events at festivals in the coming months, so please sign up to the Theos monthly newsletter and join us in person for those if you can. And don't forget to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. It'll help other people find it. Goodbye.